gonna make him an offer he can't refuse.
I have a feeling we're not in Kansas anymore.
Stuff that dreams are made of.
Gentlemen, you can't fight in here. This is the war room.
One morning, I shot an elephant in my pajamas. How he got in my pajamas, I don't know.
I am big. It's the pictures that got small.
Go ahead. Make my day.
I'm sorry, Dave. I'm afraid I can't do that.
Frankly, my dear, I don't give a damn.
Hello and welcome to Front Row Classics, a production of the Front Row Network of Shows, where we take a look at some of the greatest films ever made. And here's your host, Brandon Davis.
And hello to everybody out there in podcast land. This is Front Row Classics. I'm your host, Brandon Davis, and first time I've been on since our big Oscar-palooza a couple months ago, but who knew that time that we would all be stuck in quarantine here, but what else better to do in quarantine than podcasts? So
that's right.
We are here and we are ready to talk movies as long as we're, you know, stuck in our little bubbles. So we'll just keep doing what we do.
Mic has been thoroughly disinfected.
There's no sports, so you might as well watch movies, right?
That's right.
True. Yeah, that's true. Unless it's as Lou and I were talking about the makeshift WrestleMania coming up. Anyway, we are here and I am joined by my co-host for the last several classics episodes, Eric Flick. How's it going, Eric?
It's going well. It's going very well under the circumstances.
Yeah. Good. Absolutely. We hope all of our listeners are safe and healthy and stay that way. And then also joining me for the first time on Classics in a while is Lou Hare. How's it going, Lou?
I'm doing well, as can be expected. I echo your thoughts. I hope everyone's doing well. I hope you're taking care of yourselves physically, mentally, emotionally. I hope everybody's doing okay. And I hope we can talk about maybe a fictional emotionally wrenching experience,
yes.
As opposed to the real wrenching experience we've been living in for a while. So this will be a fun diversion.
Yeah, we are going to be discussing The Godfather Part II today. Had wanted to discuss it during Oscar season since it's a Best Picture winner, but there was so much content coming out in February, we didn't need to do it. So let's save it for when we have a lot of time on our hands.
Exactly. And here we are.
And Lou, you and I discussed the first Godfather almost 2 years ago. So
oh my gosh, that was forever.
I know. So here we are again. And I think this is the first sequel I've discussed on Classics as well. So this is pretty interesting. But this movie kind of focuses as both a prequel and a sequel.
Yeah, sequels and classics are not usually one in the same. They're not usually there's very few classic sequels, I think. But we can talk about that.
No, we could get into that toward the end probably, but we'll stick with the headline here at the beginning, and we'll start with you, Lou. We discussed our thoughts on The Godfather, but what are your just initial impressions of Part Two?
Well, I mean, I love it, first of all. I mean, I'm going to gush about this movie for a while, but I think we can talk about maybe some comparisons as we get a little deeper in. I guess to keep it light, I'll share my first knowledge of The Godfather Part Two, because I'm the Guilty Pleasures host and kind of a garbage person. My introduction to The Godfather Two was from a different sequel, and that's from City Slickers 2, The Legend of Curly's Gold. Where the John Lovitz joins the cast, he replaces Bruno Kirby, who was actually in The Godfather Part Two. And I guess maybe that's like an inside joke that I didn't realize at the time, because John Lovitz, is one of his annoying character traits is he cannot stop quoting lines from The Godfather Two.
Oh yeah,
he repeats the Hyman like. There's a moment where Daniel Stern baits him into doing the Hyman Roth speech. And I didn't know that from Adam because I was like 12 at the time. And I was like, right. Oh, okay. And he would like, he yelled one time, they're going up a mountain. He's like, this is the business we've chosen. And I'm like, okay. So, you know, fast forward a few years down the road when I get like to being an actual, you know, person who thinks, hey, maybe I should see some good movies every once in a while. And I adored The Godfather and I was like, okay, I need to get right around to watching Godfather 2. And I've seen it many times, almost maybe not as many times as The Godfather, but I love it every time I watch it. And I forget so much about it that I go, when I revisit it, there's always something I always like, oh, I forgot about that, but that's really cool too. So I'm ready to just heap praises on this movie.
Yeah, it's sort of the same when you and Jeremy and I discussed Citizen Kane. It's kind of the same thing. It's one of the few movies where no matter how many times I see it, I always forget certain things are coming up. It's like it's such intricate storytelling, and because of the narrative and the way it's done, I never quite know what's coming next. I know sort of the outline, but not exactly every little scene as I do other movies. Eric, what are your first impressions of Godfather 2?
Well, and I think one of the reasons it's easy to do that with this movie is because it's two movies in one. I mean, you already mentioned that it's a prequel and a sequel, and there are themes that float between the two, but it's they don't even look alike. You know, they're two very visually different movies in the same universe. And, you know, I probably would have loved to have been around when this one came out 2 years after the first one to see it. You know, in my mind, it's always been Godfather and Godfather Part Two was kind of just this I don't know, 6 hour epic that is all just one kind of piece that fits together. And then the Godfather Part Three is kind of over there. You know, we'll forget about that one a little bit. But I think this one fits together so well with the first movie too that in my mind, they're all just they're one epic arc.
Yeah, it really I think it's interesting. And I read just doing some research. You know, what Coppola really wanted to do was show two men, a father and a son, both at the same age, and how sort of diametrically opposed their lives were when they were at the same age. You know, you sort of see Vito's ascension and you see sort of Michael's descension into isolation and loneliness. And it's really, really interesting. And you're right. I think I love the fact that the two, they do look like two separate movies. Vito's story is really, I think I read it was like the last time any director used like that really three strip Technicolor. It looks very nostalgic and very sort of old Hollywood. And then the Michael story has more of a very 70s look to it. So
absolutely.
But, and yet it just all kind of blends together so well.
Yeah, absolutely. Just the visuals of it. I think almost the visuals, and it kind of makes sense when you think about it. I think the color palette that's being used in the Vito storyline is much more in line with the color palette used in the first Godfather.
Yeah.
And obviously there's clear reasons why that, because it's, you know, we're continuing or we're going back and telling Vito's story, who was the centerpiece of the first film. And now this like kind of new modern age story that's going on, you know, has a different kind of sheen to it. But like still great to see that, you know, Coppola is a director who's just known for such intense attention to detail that, you know, that all of that had to be, you know, completely thought out and intentional.
And just take a minute to think about how to do that in a sequel and have it match so well with that first film, to have the stories parallel the way that they do, to have the edits make sense, and then to have it be based on historical figures. I mean, some of these characters are right out of what you'd see on the History Channel about Meyer Lansky and you know, the mobsters that founded Las Vegas. To have that all work is an amazing, amazing feat.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. I love you know, and we talked about this when we talked about the first Godfather story. It's no matter how much you may disagree with the character's actions and motives, it's a uniquely American story. And it's, you know, and of course, in the early stages of the Vito story, that's all over. We'll get to that when we talk about scenes. But yeah, it's really amazing. And I love how history is sort of woven into it. But yeah, Vito's story, it shows you how different Vito and Michael are. Vito, for as bad of a guy and as bad of, you know, sins as he might have committed, he was very old worldly and he had, you know, the sort of code of ethics to him, whereas Michael just descends into villainy. And it really just shows those two stories fantastic. Before we get into characters here, any other thoughts, just sort of opening thoughts about the movie?
Yeah, I had one other thought.
Yeah.
That as I was watching it for the 20th time, maybe, you know, just a movie that's so rewatchable, just about every single scene in the movie is about family. Which is another huge feat, I think, that it's either family members talking to each other or they're talking about somebody in their family. Even the Senate trial, they say, well, we call this our family. You know, it was the Corleone family. And so to be able to put that intimacy into a film like this, too, I'm gushing here as well. But it was really... again, really an amazing feat that got pulled off.
Yeah, the scope of the movie is so impressive while still having all of those intimate characters. And I think to me that when we get to scenes, the ones I'll probably point out are those like small two-person scenes, because there's so many really, really great ones. But you can tell, you know, Coppola famously didn't want to come back and do this movie. Paramount had to beg him and like give him a dump truck of money basically and give him complete creative control. And so he just, you know, was like, okay, this is the movie I want to do. And you can see like that all on the screen in those visuals while still, but he still does a wonderful job of retaining the characters. It's not, you know, a lot of times sequels, because I know we'll talk sequels here, sequels tend to want to go bigger with their films than the previous film. And in doing so, they assume we know enough about the characters that they don't really feel the need to build on them or deepen them. And that's not what this movie does. It shows that you can continue a story and still kind of up the ante a little bit in terms of your technique.
Yeah. Yeah. Let's start getting into characters here. And of course we'll have to start with Michael. And I mean, this is Pacino's movie through and through. And you know, it really is amazing, and I think we've talked about this before, where, you know, the pre-Dick Tracy and post-Dick Tracy Pacinos are very, very different. And what I love about this era, this is Pacino at his peak, and he has such a quiet intensity throughout the movie that it's so jarring when he does burst and when he does blow up. I mean, we're used to Pacino just yelling all over the place now, but to see him play it so cool and then lose it, you know, during times of great, you know, turmoil in his life, it's really something. And the thing about Michael is he never, even though I said he descends into villainy, they never make him a cardboard cutout. There's always real motive behind what he does. And I think that's mainly because of the way Pacino plays it.
Yeah, you see the wheels turning on him all the time. You can tell he's like always a guy who's thinking about what's going to happen next while like fighting this kind of undercurrent of rage. The moment that strikes out to me is the scene with Kay. I know we'll dive into that a little bit deep, you know, where you see his like lip quivering with rage, like as she's talking to him, and it's like, it's so intense. And I know I mentioned this when we talked about The Godfather, you know, in the first Godfather, you watch like Michael grow because based on his eye contact. And watching it again this time, you realize he has this like steely eye glazed, like daggers with everyone he speaks to. And it's not until we get that flashback scene where we're reminded of kind of the Shire kid and what he used to be like, because that guy's totally dead and gone and this is all that we have.
Yeah, he's not the... he's not the young war hero that he started the first movie out of. And it's such a transformation. And you're right. You don't think about it until you see that flashback scene at the end.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. Eric.
Yeah. And I don't know that you can say enough about the performance here for Pacino, and, you know, well-deserved Academy Award for this one. And there are a few famous lines and there are those few famous scenes, but he's not even really doing the dialogue work in this one. I think, Lou, you hit it on the head where it's in his eyes and it's there the entire performance. And to have that consistently throughout, you know, an epically long movie is a tough feat to pull off, but it's an amazing, amazing performance that is one of the things that makes this movie so instantly rewatchable, is that there's something every time that I see this movie and what he's doing, even when he's not speaking, that is entertaining.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. Michael on this watch was so interesting to me, just to think about where he came from and what we watch. You know, I think the first movie is watching him transform from a kind of a naive, idealistic kid into kind of watching him get sucked into the family business. And then in this one, I forgot how much he truly, how distant Michael is from his family, almost like from the jump. He has very few scenes, like he has individual scenes with each family member, but there's never a scene, you never see him pick up his kids. You never see him hug, like, you know, his kids are in the room, but you never see him like show affection to them or really show affection to anybody. And that was like the one thing that really stood out to me with him, his character was, you know, and then when you get to that last scene of the flashback where he talks about, I'm just going to go to the army. I don't care what you guys say. I don't care what the family says. And it gives you, like, it ties it all together that Michael's always been a guy who's never really cared about his family in this movie that's about family.
Mm-hmm. Right.
You know? And he, you know, he's sucked into the family business in the first one because he kind of has to. And then it just through circumstance, he gets a taste of it and he gets sucked in. And then by this time he's like fully just like drunk with power.
Yeah.
And has shunned everything away from him to the point where he literally then ends that natural arc is killing one of his own family members. Spoiler alert.
And I love how much that ties back to the first movie where we have this character break. And what he does is he murders all of his enemies at the end of the first movie. And this is showing us what happens after that. You know, what did that do to that person's character? And it's another great arc to explore of how he was broken in that first movie, but continued to grow in his power and his madness at the same time.
Yeah. And he has that scene with Kay where he's like, hey, at the end of the first one, where he's like, hey, the Corleone family is going to be legitimate. This is where I'm working to. We are working. This is what I am working towards. And it just never happens. The other thing that one of my favorite lines from the first one is a line that Vito says to Sonny, or he says it when Sonny walks into the room in that first like scene, or he's talking to Johnny Fontaine and he goes, you spend time with your family? Good. Cause a man who never spends time with his family can never be a real man.
Right.
Yeah.
And then in the second one, what do we see? Michael never spends time with his family.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right. No. Yeah.
So, it really is. And going back to what you were saying, Lou, about he, in the first movie, he was very paternal to Connie in the first movie, I feel like. But in this one, he's never aggressive with her, but he's very cold. And so it's like, yeah, even because it's almost like, well, you've killed all your enemies. So now, you know, who's left but your family to sort of let, you know, destroy from within. And yeah, it's just amazing. And what's interesting about Michael is the way that he's become such a distinct problem solver. And it's so fascinating to watch Pacino, like in the whole Hyman Roth situation and him figuring out, you know, the whole betrayal and what's been going on. You know, you a lot of the stuff is happening off screen. You just hear it talked about, but to see him sort of figure everything out, for him to sort of, you know, be the problem solver, it's just fascinating to see Pacino do that. And just, like I said, it's his movie. But mm-hmm. let's move on. I guess the next character we should talk about, though, is the other person whose story it is, and that's Vito, even though De Niro doesn't get a whole lot of screen time. But really, the sort of the first sort of big explosion that Robert De Niro made on screen. And he, like I said, he doesn't get a whole lot of screen time, but he really makes an impression to where he won a supporting actor Oscar for this movie. And I think he really captures sort of the old world dignified Italian, customs while, sort of adapting to this life of crime that he somehow gets thrown to in those early years in New York. We'll start with you, Eric. What are your thoughts on De Niro in this movie?
Yeah. So not only does he not have a lot of screen time, mm-hmm. but most of the words that he speaks, which are very few, yeah. aren't even in English. Yeah. So he's speaking Italian most of the time. The amount that he gets out of the character with just that little bit is pretty amazing. And somehow he captures the essence of what Brando did with the character too. Here's a guy that has never been handed anything, knows what it is to take care of his family and knows that he has to do things that aren't right with his own moral code, but he does them anyway just to take care of his family. So De Niro in this one, he is also moving with a physicality that doesn't really mirror Pacino. Pacino's doing a lot with his eyes, but De Niro's moving across the screen in such a way that is just incredible to watch as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Lou?
Yeah, and I like what you'd mentioned, Derek, about the whole kind of the family idea. And in this one, they kind of extrapolated a little bit to be about community, which was another juxtaposition I kind of missed in previous viewings. It really struck me. Maybe it's because we're in a phase right now where communities are isolated from each other and we're all kind of reaching out for something or whatever. But the fact that Vito really starts his journey to prominence out of a desire to kind of right some wrongs within his community. He is this kind of Robin Hood-esque, I guess, to take on the Don in that who's bullying people and he's taking advantage of people. And so he's doing it for the little guy. He's the one who feels, hey, I can stand up for the little guy, and in doing so, he gets power. And it's about that kind of that loyalty, building on loyalty, which rises him to power. Whereas when you get to Michael and you're watching Michael, he's actively shunning his community. Yeah. He's moved away from New York. He's not associated. All of the scenes we see of him are not with any of the inner circle. There's not even any of the, they make a point that he's hanging out with all these, waspy, businessmen instead of his Italian brethren, his people, I don't know if that's the right way to say that, but and so it's, again, that's juxtaposition of this guy rising to power by embracing community and this other guy isolating himself from him.
Because in the first movie, Vito, people in the community felt comfortable coming to him mm-hmm. and, asking him for favors or whatever, whereas mm-hmm. Michael just strikes fear into everybody and no one wants to even approach him.
And Brando in that first scene is so comforting.
Yeah.
When people are requesting, he's mm-hmm. Yeah, okay, I hear you. And he pushes back on, I remember when he's talking to, the Undertaker, and he's talking about, I'm not going to kill, but I will, yeah. I'll help you. I'm going to help you. And it doesn't seem to be a burden. He's not burdened by it. Whereas right. Michael feels just burdened constantly.
Yeah.
Yeah, and De Niro captures that well by helping out the widow that comes to him who's got the dog in the apartment, and he has to solve that problem, and you see that same sort of I'm going to solve your problem, but I'm really sympathetic to you as well. That both Brando and De Niro give to that character.
Right. Yeah, his methods aren't legal. But they're coming from a good place, at least.
Yeah,
yeah. And there's just, and I guess it's just the way De Niro plays it. There's an innate goodness in what he's doing, and maybe it's just because we've sort of followed his rise and we know where he's come from. But there's, and you're, and I think you were right when you said, you know, Robin Hood, there is sort of this rob from the rich, give to the poor mentality of him, where he's sort of made himself a social warrior in a way, by committing some, you know, not so great crimes, but still, but yeah. And this really sort of, it's amazing to see De Niro at this point where he'd, you know, been kind of a struggling actor, and to see him sort of really get a foothold in this movie, you know, I'm sure when people went to see this sequel, you know, you don't have Brando, you don't have James Caan, you know, and, you know, who's this new guy here? But he really sort of, you know, takes over, and you're with him for that whole ride. And I always thought that De Niro had much more to do in this than he does. And he's really only in about a fourth of the movie. He only clocks in a little, you know, I think less than an hour of this three hour movie. So that's pretty good for him to create such a foothold.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And to go up against an iconic character.
Yeah.
I mean, he's not just like recreating, you know, just any old character. I mean, The Godfather is still ingrained in our minds. And, you know, he honors Brando's performance, but he makes it his own too.
He really does. He really does. All right. Well, let's move on. I guess the next character we'll talk about is Tom Hagen, played by Robert Duvall. And I always, you know, to me, the character of Tom Hagen is kind of the glue in this. He's really, everybody else is sort of working at the sort of operatic level. And Tom Hagen is very much sort of the salt of the earth here. But, you know, in the first movie, he never wavers, and he never disagrees with anything, you know, and in this movie he loses his footing within the Corleone family, and it's really interesting to see. But I think Robert Duvall plays this character so steadily, and he's so great playing this sort of go between the Corleones and polite society. It's really great to see.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think with Duvall, I don't know about you guys, but maybe I'm wrong here. When I my first thought of Duvall, or when I think somebody talks about Robert Duvall, we think of like later age Robert Duvall, kind of like the more gruff, grizzled Robert Duvall. Mm-hmm. And you forget like just how much of a like kind of a sensitive soul Tom Hagen is.
Yeah.
And it's the scene where he and Michael have together where Pacino kind of, or like Michael brings him back into the family. He's like, you're the only one that I trust. I've always thought of you like a brother. And like he is genuinely touched by that. And I was like, man, that was a really touching moment. You know, it doesn't last, but he just has that, you know, innate goodness about him. That is this, like, he's a, I don't know what I'm looking for. He's the, I don't know. He's the one that, out of all of these like trash people, he's the one that you're like, oh, I kind of, even though he does bad things too, he's the one who you feel maybe has a soul that isn't completely decayed.
Well, and I was saying, it's not like he wasn't born into this family. He was chosen to be in this family. So I think there's this sort of, he feels as though he owes something to them. So he's going to go above and beyond whatever they do.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I think too that Michael realizes that in some way Tom Hagen is his last connection to his father.
Yeah.
So his sister sort of abandons the family and is just trying to get money out of the family. And Fredo's obviously doing Fredo things. and Tom, who was his dad's consigliere, however you pronounce that word, is Michael's last connection to that old world way of things that are getting done. And I think Tom really does genuinely appreciate when he's brought back into the family. And then you see, you know, an hour and a half later in the film when Michael's criticizing him and he says, what's going on? You know, haven't I always been loyal to you? Just like he was loyal to his dad. And that's the minute I think that Tom realizes too, that Michael's gone. He's beyond redemption here too.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And I think that's interesting. And I think we'll get into it also when we talk about Hyman Roth. But Tom Hagen was dealing with a generation of guys who it's almost like everything was business and nothing was taken personally, whereas Michael takes everything personally. And that is, and you know, and Tom's like, okay, I'm dealing with a different kind of boss here. Mm-hmm. And
he says right to Michael too, when are you done? And do you have to kill everyone? And Michael says, no, just my enemies.
Right.
But he's pointing it out. He's exactly saying that thing that you're saying, Brandon, that this isn't the way that things were done in the past.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. We won't talk too much of Godfather 3. We'll save that for guilty pleasures, but, one of the many sins of that movie is not ponying up the money for Robert Duvall, because I do think there was more story that could have been told between Michael and Tom, and to just kind of write him off because you didn't feel, you know, he was worth whatever that he was asking for is really sad, because I was like, man, I would love to see that. That's the one relationship that still has room to develop, I think, because the K relationship is kind of cut off, although they do bring it back in the third. But there's like, oh man, I could see there could be some interesting story to have been had, but alas, it was not to be.
All right. Well, let's talk about the other brother here. Let's talk about Fredo, John, because I think Cazale is how you pronounce it. Mm-hmm. And really, really great performance, Oscar nominated performance. Really, once again, you know, he's still kind of the mousy guy that he was in the first movie, but there's a lot more level to him in this one. And, you know, and some of his stuff is just heartbreaking. I think, like in the scene where Michael fake forgives him, and he thinks, okay, maybe there is hope, but you know, as it turns out, there's not. But certainly, and I think I knew what you were referring to earlier, Lou, about two person scenes, but him and Michael's scene together is just phenomenal. But yeah, a really, really sort of the tragic character in all of this.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and before we get into him, that moment where he kind of fakes forgives, that's another great eye moment from Pacino, because he hugs Fredo, but he looks up at his guy and he's like, this is what's happening. You know what that look means? Okay, we all know. Okay, you know?
Yeah.
You know? And we're like, oh,
we all know.
And Pacino delivers it in the way that, he says he's forgiven him, but like, and so there's that like cloud hanging over the rest of it that it's just like, ah. And then you watch him be so sweet in the end when he's like teaching Michael's son about fishing, and he's just back to being kind of dopey, sweet Fredo.
Yeah.
That it's heartbreaking.
Yeah.
It really, and because it's played with such a vulnerability that, had he not been up against Robert De Niro, probably should have won the Academy Award for this role. I just think that this one in rewatching it is one of the truly amazing performances. A brother that all he wants is to be accepted by his family, tries to do his best, and it ends up costing him his life. I mean, it's just an amazing story arc there. And the, like you said, Lou, the sweetness that comes out of that character when he knows that he did something wrong. He knows the consequences of that, but thinks he's forgiven and just wants to be the best uncle, father figure to his nephew that he can possibly be. And ends so tragically. It's just a great, great arc.
Yeah, and there's that moment, of course, in the famous last scene. You know, it's I think Fredo knows as soon as Connie comes and says, you know, that, you know, Michael's going to take him to Reno now, and the minute where he tells Al Neri, okay, let's go, he knows what he's in for, he plays that so well, just that he's sort of resigned himself to the fact, okay, I knew this was coming for a long time, and here it comes. And you know, and then of course, you know, sitting there and praying and all of that. But there's such a poetic part, you know, aspect to it that, you know, Michael is at least allowing him to do what he loved to do at the very last moment.
Yeah. And what I love about John Cazale, if you're not familiar with his work, you know, for those, you know, younger listeners, he passes away at a very early age. He dies at age 42. I believe he passes away in 1978. So he's not, you know, he's not long for this world when he's making this film. But he does, he's in movies that all of the movies he's been in were nominated or won Best Picture. He does Dog Day Afternoon, Godfather 1 and 2. He's in The Conversation, and he's also in The Deer Hunter.
He dated Meryl Streep, too.
Yes, and Meryl Streep, like, kind of, you know, talked about him as being, like, kind of a muse and an inspiration in terms of acting ability. And one of the things that I love about this, you know, you talk a lot about physicality of actors, and what he does so well as Fredo is watch his, with Pacino, it's all kind of about the eyes. We talked about De Niro. It's kind of all about the physique or the stature. With him, it's all about the posture. He is always slumped. He's always down. And in that famous scene, he's not even like, he's not sitting up. He's like a puddle of a human being. He has like, it's like he has no bones at all, you know?
Yeah.
He, and juxtaposed with Michael, who's this stoic, very strong-willed force. And he's such just like, you know, you can see that he is like, okay, I know Fredo's easily manipulated, you know? And so he's kind of like water. He's just kind of this, you know, unformed mass, and he just embodies that so well that he's like, yeah, he's always slumped and he's always easy to be pushed around, and the moment that he has where he's like trying to fight back and give his justification to Michael, but it doesn't land because he never gets to, you know, he never can get in Michael's face because he just doesn't have the strength to do that.
He never has a backbone.
No backbone. Yeah, he's just jello.
Yeah. Yeah. It's like, you know, the scene in Cuba, you know, when the revolution begins and Michael's trying to get him to get into the car. But he's always been so good at weaseling his way out and everything. But of course, it all catches up to him at the end.
Right.
Yeah. Eric, any other thoughts on Fredo?
No, I think we covered it. Well, I think we'll get back to him when we talk about favorite scenes because he's in a lot of them in this movie.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, let's talk about Kay. Let's talk about Diane Keaton. It's interesting, you know, in the first movie, it's interesting to see her sort of become the sort of unwitting member of this family. You know, it takes her the entire length of the first movie to really find out what she's in for. And now, of course, with the expanse of time and dropping into this new movie, she knows exactly the kind of family she is. And now it's kind of her story in terms of finding her own way and getting out and sort of becoming her own person again. And I think I said, you know, we know Diane Keaton so much for comedy, and to see her play a truly dramatic role like this mm-hmm. is really, really fantastic.
Yeah, this is, I was listening to this at the Unspooled talk about this movie, and it was pointed out this is 3 years before Annie Hall.
Yeah.
And so to see this, and then it's so funny to me to watch it kind of in reverse. Cause like you said, Brandon, I think most of us, our first introduction to Diane Keaton, if we are, you know, depending on our age, is probably like Father of the Bride or Annie
First
Hall
Wives
or
Club.
First Wives Club, yeah. All of those comedic vehicles. But it's kind of interesting to know that she is this like fantastic dramatic actress who then like segues into becoming like one of the best, you know, comedic actresses of her generation.
Yeah. And I will certainly get into it during, you know, favorite scenes, but her going toe to toe with Pacino during the abortion reveal is just too fast. It's a masterclass of acting watching these two go at it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And to have this character find their inner strength and their spine to stand up to this person that we all know has amazing power. And, you know, she's up against the king, you know, at this point, and to stand toe to toe with him like that is really a fun watch there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And she's the only one who gets to do it. She's the only one who can do it, because anyone else Anyone who's not the mother of his children would be dead.
Yeah.
Including his family members. I mean, right? It's so you're absolutely right. It's poignant.
Yeah. It's their relationship is so Shakespearean. It's King Lear, it's Macbeth, it's all of that rolled into one. Mm-hmm. What I always think of is like the scene where Connie is allowing her to come and sneak in and see the kids. And, you know, and they sneak out, and then of course, you know, Michael sees her, and there's like that twinge of hope that maybe, you know, everything's okay with him when he just slams the door in her face, and just that little look that she gives right before it slams. Her acting choices in this are incredible.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And it's such a great example of maximizing your minutes, to use a sports term, because she's not in the film very much.
No.
And when she is in the film up and really until that point, she's in the background. You know, she sits behind him at the Senate hearing, and she's there, but she's not there. And part of that is to, you know, further drive the point home of how far Michael has gotten away from his family. Cause we never, the only time he shows any, real care for him is when the guns come in is the assassination attempt. Yeah. But even then it's not like he's just covering her. He's not like caring for her or calming her. It really drives that point home. And then it's like, it's kind of bottled up, and she gets that moment, and it's like, yeah, here we go. And she unloads on him and has the one way to hurt him. I had a question for you guys, because this was brought up when I've heard people discuss this, scene. There's the discussion. Some would believe that Cade does not actually have the abortion, and that's a lie. Any thoughts on this?
Yeah. And I've heard similar discussions on that, but I think that she did have the abortion, and I think it's because she knows that, for everything that Michael is, he's got this religious background. So she's doing everything that she can to stab back at him. And that is the one thing that she can do. So there's this, the aspect of the Catholicism, his obsession with his family, the fact that what we don't know is if she knew it was a son or not. But the fact that she says that too tells me that she's so full of the venom and the vitriol that she is going to do whatever it takes to hurt him. And it's not just words. I think she really did go through with an abortion.
I feel like if it was a lie, we would somehow, as the audience, know that in the narrative. I mean, we don't have to, but I can see why people would come up with it, because it's an equal way to hurt him, you know, and just sort of, it's also maybe a way to lie to herself so she doesn't have to deal with the grief of a miscarriage. Mm-hmm.
Well, and I think some of the theories about it come from the idea that, you know, this is in the 1950s. At that point, abortion wasn't legal. Abortion was only legal 2 years before this movie came out. So, like, it would be shocking for her to admit that to an audience, you know. But the fact no one, you know, if you just think, and maybe this is just maybe a plot hole that we're think too much about. You think of the logistics of somebody would have had to take her. She would have had to have found a doctor. She would have, you know, no one in the family knows this. No one in the family knows this secret. Like Tom comes to Michael and says she had a miscarriage, but you know, who took her to the hospital? Who was present for that? You know?
Yeah.
So it's again, I think you're both right.
Yeah. Yeah, being married to a mob boss, I mean, she would have the means and money to figure that out.
Sure.
And I think it puts her at the same level. She becomes a murderer too. Mm-hmm. There's sort of the line that Michael has when he's talking to Hagen about getting to Hyman Roth. You know, if history has shown us anything, we can always get to someone. I mean, I think she would have found a way to get that to happen. So I'm not sure that there's a huge logic trap there.
Well, and it makes so much more sense for the character, because this is not, you know, this is not an unwanted pregnancy, at least from Michael's side. This is not a life of the mother situation. This is her willfully making the choice to do this to hurt Michael, because I don't want to get into the thorny debate, political debate about abortion on this podcast, but you know, but the fact that she is crystal clear, I did this to hurt you. I did this because this child is toxic. You're toxic. This whole family is toxic. And yeah, that's the, it plays to me much better if it's that regard, but I thought I'd bring it up.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah. Let's really, I mean, we've discussed the major characters. There's, of course, there's Hyman Roth still, played by Lee Strasberg, which I read, incidentally, I think they had originally wanted James Cagney to play that part, which would have been fascinating to see him do that. But Lee Strasberg does it very well.
Mm-hmm.
And correct me if I'm wrong, Pacino lobbied. So he was the acting coach that essentially invented the method.
He started the method, yes.
And so Pacino sort of lobbied for him to be in this movie.
Yeah.
And he's not in very many films at all. His film career is very short.
Right. Yeah, this is actually his first film. He was more of a stage actor and then later on acting coach.
But for him to come out and do these things that Hyman Roth does, these snorts and sort of noises that he makes as this character, as he gets frustrated, that kind of shows his illness. I mean, those are some bold choices that really work.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. There's no ego in his performance, which is great to see.
No. And he does one of those things, which, you know, I don't want to sound like, oh, it's such a theater thing. It's going to make me sound really snobby, but you know, one of the things that when you see like a theatrically trained actor is kind of owning a space a little bit and finding unique kind of character quirks or traits and just kind of living in that situation, which is a lot easier to do in a play as opposed to a film where, there's all these technical elements going on around you and you're doing the same line 50 times from 50 different ways. So when you create a play, it's a lot more about creating a more lived in experience. And like the first scene when we see Hyman Roth and he's got his leg draped over the chair, like as comfortable as he, like he's kicking it, just like, you know, as just chill as he could be, for being some sort of big time, you know, casino mob boss, that you just know that's one of those things that in like a Strasberg would think in that kind of that method where you think about, okay, how would my character sit in a chair? And we make fun of method acting sometimes because we sometimes like equate it with, oh, I'm going to, you know, starve myself for 90 days because that's what this character went through type thing.
Yeah.
And really what it's about is it's like trying to find like those little like humanistic details in every little moment.
Uh-huh.
And that's what he does. And it's so great. It's a great performance.
Yeah. And he gets some fantastic speeches. I love, you know, and his use of the language that they give him to say and everything. Only someone as theatrically trained as he could deliver some of that the way he does. And it's interesting to watch Pacino, who's a consummate film actor, and Strasberg, who's a consummate theater actor, play together, because it's really like watching two bullfighters, you know, going up against each other in an arena.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. All right. Well, let's see. The only we do have Michael Gozzo as Pentangeli, and he's another one of the major characters of this. Another kind of sad figure in the movie that really makes a turn. Eric, what are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, sad. A little Fredo-esque.
Yeah.
I mean, here's the guy who is now in charge of the New York arm of the Corleone family and can't live up to Vito, can't live up to Michael, is losing it to the Rosato brothers. And you kind of feel for this guy. And he's part of that representation, Lou, that you were talking about earlier, where he's the old school Italian. He, at the beginning of the movie, he tries to get the band to play the tarantella and they can't do it. And so he comes across as this bumbling fool, and his old ways don't work anymore.
Yeah.
And it almost comes around to bite Michael in the butt, because this guy gets caught and the only place that he can go is the FBI.
Yeah.
So, you know, another great arc through this story that's really well acted all the way through.
Yeah, I think it's a really good performance. You know, this actually leads to kind of one of the one of my criticisms of the film is, you know, this character was originally supposed to be Clemenza from the first film. Uh-huh. And what Richard Castellano was supposed to come back and reprise his role. But ultimately he pulled out of the film because like, okay, says so the first Godfather we should remember is not just like a critical hit. It's like the most, it's the most popular movie of all time at that point. Mm-hmm. You know, it's like getting people to come back after Avengers Endgame, you know, it's like, okay, if you want to come back, you got to like, and so everyone, like we don't think of him as a big time actor, but they were like, hey, you want me back, you got to pony up some dough.
Right.
And so they didn't, a couple of as much. And second, he didn't like the fact that he was going to betray, his character was going to betray Michael, which he didn't think fit his character. Cause he's the Clemenza was the guy in the first one. They pointed out was not didn't want to go against the family.
Right.
And then thirdly, he lost a whole bunch of weight cause he thought he was going to play young Clemenza.
Oh, yeah.
And he didn't want to have to go back and gain 50 pounds again. And so all of those reasons. So Frankie Pentangeli is basically a stand-in for Clemenza. And I do think the movie would have worked a lot better in that regard because you're kind of introduced to this kind of random dude who we didn't know and are meant to feel like, oh, he lives in the Corleone house? Like, and you know, that moment doesn't land as much, but the moment where he like tries to get him to play the tarantella would have been a great callback to his moment in the wedding scene in the first film where he kind of takes over the dance floor.
Right.
Yeah.
So you can see like the remnants of that character still in the script. But it's an interesting idea. But to say nothing, I mean, Michael Gazzo has a great performance in it. Yes. But as you guys kind of pointed out, yeah, he's completely out of his depth in this area, which is also how Clemenza would have been had he tried to betray Michael.
Absolutely. Absolutely. All right. Let's segue now to favorite scenes in this movie. There's a lot of them, but you kind of mentioned it, Lou. What I love and I'll say about the two movies, they both start with a big party. And they're so incredibly different. Mm-hmm. One is very, you know, it's a classic wedding, you know, and there's such elegance to it and such, so much of the culture. And then you just see in the second one, how corrupted the Corleone family has become by money and, you know, the Nevada lifestyle where, it's just how show busy it's all become. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's actually great, like, little metaphor for sequels in general.
Yeah.
Because Michael's literally doing the exact same thing his father would have done.
Right.
But it doesn't have any meaning behind it other than the money, other than the opulence, which Absolutely. Is how so many sequels are, you know? They're like, we'll just do the same thing that we did the last time. It's but he's doing the same thing as a wedding for a first communion as he did for his dad did for his daughter's wedding. Yeah. And it's like, dude, dial it down a notch. It's like,
absolutely.
And I love that his son points it out too. He's like, I don't even know those people that gave me the money.
All right. Yeah. Yeah. So, Eric, what's one of your favorite scenes?
So I've made the conscious decision to just pick three scenes, and I'm sure that we're going to cover all these, because there are so many. But my absolute favorite is the most quotable line, maybe one of the most quotable movie lines of all time. And it's when, the brothers are in Cuba and they're about to get out of there. And Michael is just simmering. He knows what Fredo has done. Fredo doesn't know that he knows. And he grabs him and just plants the kiss on his face and says, you know, I know what you did, Fredo. You broke my heart. I mean, just one of the best movie scenes that ever there was. And it's not just Pacino. Lou, you mentioned it too. It's the physical acting of the Fredo character who just absolutely wilts, is shocked and wilts at the same time. And it's just a powerful scene, and it's so intimate in this huge party that's going on around them that I'm hard pressed to find, you know, better scenes in movie history.
It's sort of at the dawn of Cuba's revolution. Michael is about to strike his own revolution within his own family. And
yes.
You're right. An intimate moment between two brothers with the most dramatic surrounding you can think of.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's such a great, you know, opulent scene. And then there's this incredibly intimate moment that's happening. It's perfect for everything you said, Eric. It's one of the reasons why that line sticks in American history.
Yeah. Lou, what's one of yours?
Well, I think I mentioned the Tom Hagen Michael scene as one of them. I think one of the things I did like the most is since we haven't talked about it too much, is kind of the flashback scene.
Yeah,
because it really does tell you a lot, reveal something. A lot of times sequels will do this thing where they reveal something about a character that you didn't know from the first movie, but It also kind of feels disjointed and out of place because it like retroactively makes the first one not make sense. And this one doesn't do that. And in fact, they take a scene that clearly is just kind of an excuse to get James Caan in the movie for some reason. Yeah. And it was an excuse to get Brando in the movie. But he famously no-showed that day, because never forget that Marlon Brando was a very weird, weird human being, regardless of what a great actor he was. He was temperamental. He was eccentric and he could be an ass. Mm-hmm. But so he no-shows and they had to rewrite the scene. And it was just kind of again, it could have been a moment that felt like this cynical, tacked on cash grab scene, but really informs the dynamic of the relationship where you realize that it's Sonny who introduces Carlo to Connie. You still see the family dynamic at play, and then it's Michael's defiance has existed from the beginning. He's never wanted to be a part of this family. He wants the business, and now he wants the business, but he doesn't want the family. And then that silhouette that, you know, flashes him back to the scene where he is, you know, after Fredo's been murdered and he's like in that spotlight with his hand to his face. And it's that moment where, you know, the first movie ends with his hand getting kissed by somebody.
Yeah.
The second movie starts with his hand getting kissed by somebody, and this one ends with him kissing his own. Like, he's not kissing his hand, but it's in a similar pose. It's a similar tableau where it's like he's got no one but himself. Yeah. And it's just that kind of beautiful of he used to have – if he had just been with his family, if he had just – and he doesn't go out to greet Vito at the door for his birthday. He didn't really care about his dad that much.
Yeah.
He's going to ruin his dad's birthday by saying he just enlisted in the Army or in the Marines, you know?
Right.
So.
Yeah. One of the I'll go to some of the prequel stuff. The whole Ellis Island sequence I just think is beautifully done. What Roger Ebert wrote about this movie is the score to Godfather 2 is even more important to the movie than what the score to Godfather 1 is, because I don't know, there's something in the way that Nina Rota scores that and the way that it's shot with that old sort of stock film footage, and it has such a nostalgia to it and all of that. And I don't know if any other movie sequence in history has ever really sort of shown, you know, the process of how Ellis Island worked and all of that, the way it does when you see young Vito go through that and, you know, sort of, you know, how he's all by himself and he's got to, you know, here he is in a new country and he's going to make it on his own somehow. It is a very American, you know, story in that way. But yeah, I don't know. It deepens the movie and it makes it, you know, much more than just your typical gangster film.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I like that grounding effect that it brings to it.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Eric, what's another one?
Well, sticking with that aspect of the film where we're doing sort of the prequel, just the whole sequence of the St. Joseph's Day Parade or whatever the feast that they're celebrating, the Feast of San Gennaro or whatever it is, where you have this Don Fanucci dressed in the fine, you know, white silks and walking through the crowd, and just the visual image that he is. And at the same time, he's being stalked by Robert De Niro, hopping from rooftop to rooftop. And then just how that whole scene of that assassination plays out is just amazing. The one of the things that Coppola does so much better is just sits in the silence of it. You know, there are no lines when that's going on. You know, there's maybe some characters saying some very mundane or irrelevant things, but it's very quiet. And it's very quiet when you see De Niro moving from rooftop to rooftop. There's the music of the festival, which is very bustling, but it still plays as a very quiet scene that leads up to this, you know, very violent act that, you know, has the same surprise that in Godfather 1 when Michael goes to get the gun from behind the toilet. And there's no dialogue, but you're on the edge of your seat the entire time. And I think that that scene just plays so well here.
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm.
Lou?
Yeah, well, I mean, I got to single out, you know what a Rocky stan I am. So I got to point out Talia Shire.
Yeah, we didn't talk about Connie.
We haven't talked about her much. And you know, I think that's typical for how even the Corleones view her. or even – and it's also tells you, like, just, again, both of these films, what a deep – bench this movie has, because she's what, the sixth, seventh biggest role in the film, and still, like, it has such a great scene. In the scene where she's begging Michael, the two scenes she gets with Michael, the first one, the fight that they have over her new boyfriend, and then the other one where she's begging him to take Fredo back. She's so great at those. And then when you know, again, you juxtapose it with how understated she is in the Rocky films. You know, and especially in that first one, that she has just kind of these, you know, big emotional swings. And Connie, who is such a tragic character, I think she may be the most tragic of all the Corleones, because nothing's ever expected of her. She's never given anything, and she's just like passed off to her first husband beats her, and then is murdered. And then she's kind of thrown to, discarded by the family. Like, if we ever talk Godfather 3, she's the one character who I feel gets a little bit of redemption in the third one. Mm-hmm. But no, that's the two scenes she has with Michael, I just think are great. And I think she's an underrated actress. I just think in general, I don't think, beyond Godfather and the Rocky films, we don't get much from her. But we should. She's still around. Let's get her on something. Get on that Netflix.
Yeah.
I want to tell you Shire vehicle.
There you go.
I got nothing else to do right now.
Let's see. The only, well, we haven't talked about it either. I love the full circle scene during the De Niro sequence where he goes back and kills the Don that killed his mother and father. Mm-hmm. I think it's so interesting how, you know, this old mafia Don, who I'm sure has done many horrible things in his life, is just sitting there accepting guests on a porch with no major security around him.
Mm-hmm. No, just asleep, just napping in the sun.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. But I love the De Niro's quiet intensity. That could have been played up, you know, so much, you know, as my revenge moment, but, you know, just the little bit of the whisper and the way that he sticks the knife in and, you know, gets out of there, you know, it's done so well. I love those two bookend scenes of him at the beginning, seeing his mother get killed, and him coming back to do that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Any other scenes that were, I'm sure there are, but.
No, I guess the character we haven't talked about him, the character of the senator, Senator Geary, who we see kind of like he's a great example of how distant the Corleone family has kind of gotten, because when he's in that, like, I love the flex that he has of intentionally mispronouncing the Corleone's name at the first communion party. And then you're like, oh, is this guy a moron? And then there's the scene when they meet together and he reveals, no, I know how to say your name.
Yeah.
I'm not going to, because I'm, you know, I'll take your money, but I clearly think less of you.
Yeah.
To then get it flipped on its head when, you know, Michael, you know, when Tom has to bail him out of a situation, which again was another question of whether or not when Senator Geary is found with the dead prostitute, does he actually murder the prostitute or do they kill the prostitute and make him think that he's done it?
Ooh.
Yeah, I think that the that has all the marks of they wanted Geary in their pocket and they set him up.
Yeah.
And they drugged his drink with whatever or made sure that he had so much drink that he wasn't going to remember. And then they went in there and, yeah. and set the, all of that up. And then just waited for him to wake up and then said, hey, here, we're, hey, look, we're your best friends. We're here to help you out.
Yeah.
That felt like a very Corleone thing to do.
Yeah, I figured that that's probably how it went.
Yeah, I'd agree. And that's, again, that's one of those things where it's a callback to the other thing that Tom Hagen is a part of, and that's the horse's head scene, the first one.
Yeah, absolutely.
Those are the two most graphic scenes in both of the films, and we're led to believe that Tom has a direct relationship to those two things, which is kind of bonkers when you think about it, because we were just talking about Tom being this moral compass and this like sweet presence. And I guess it's because we never see him physically harm anybody.
True.
And I don't know, like he was the one who cut the horse's head off or whatever, but we know that we see him with the guy, with the director, and then the next thing is the horse's head.
Mm-hmm.
And then we see him next to the dead hooker, and he's the one coming in to clean up the situation. So it's like,
I mean, for all we know, those are Tom's ideas.
He's the most talented at not leaving a trail back to him.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Cause he either did it himself or he orchestrated them.
Yeah.
And like, that's even more like that's so sinister, but which again, a great, you know, the fact that you're not quite sure is a nice little thought, because yeah, he's the smartest of the whole bunch.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, there's so many little, I do love the whole Senate scene where Pitangeli is changing the story on the affidavit, mm-hmm. and you see how that whole Senate committee is totally out of their league at dealing with mm-hmm. all of this, and just the confusion and them bringing his brother in. That whole scene is set up and done so well. And it looks almost documentary. It looks like it could be like a C-SPAN broadcast or something.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and I think that's no accident. I mean, it almost looked like the archival footage of some of the Nuremberg trial stuff too, which people would have been familiar with how those looked.
Mm-hmm.
Uh-huh. Absolutely. Absolutely. Any other scenes before we move on?
I think that's, I mean, the whole movie's great.
Exactly. Exactly.
Right. Right. Let's see. Just looking at trivia, I did read a section where, what is it? Oh, apparently at one point Pacino was not happy with a certain portion of the script and refused to come back on set until it was fixed. And so I think Coppola stayed up all night rewriting.
Yes. Yeah. Yep. Again, everyone in this movie, just like the Godfather went to everyone's head. There was no one who like was just humble about their success. Maybe Diane Keaton. I'll give her credit. She's always seemed, you know, like good
down people. To earth.
Like,
yeah.
Yeah. But like everyone, like James Caan famously got the exact leverage to get the exact same pay for that one scene as he got for being in The Godfather. It's insane. Oh, that reminds me. That's the moment. That's the same. I'm glad that's my stream of consciousness brain going. And cause I don't have my notes from me. It's been a long day, people. The flashback scenes where you see Vito with his sons.
Yes.
It's so interesting because there are moments that foreshadow all of the kids. Mm-hmm. Because, and Sonny's was the first one that I noticed, because they get this carpet and it's this blood red carpet and they lay Sonny down on it. And so the last image you see of that scene is Sonny laying down. Baby Sonny laying down on this blood red carpet, which is just this, like, I didn't notice until this time. I was like, that is amazing. Like, that's, again, prequels sometimes are sloppy about like trying to like back end themselves to connect to their originals. And that is just such an elegant way of just being like, you know, it's a little tip of the hat to what we know happens to Sonny.
Yeah.
And then you have Fredo, who won't stop crying, who's constantly needy, who constantly needs to be taken care of. And then you have Michael, who never makes a sound, who's always being carried by his dad.
Yeah. Yes. Whenever we see his dad's, you know, when the last scene that they you have with De Niro, he's holding Michael and saying, "Say goodbye, Michael," and waving at, out the train window.
Yeah,
and then Connie, who's just there.
Yeah,
like, kind of appropriate.
That's true,
right? Like they just like that. Okay, sorry for that diversion back to favorite scenes, but.
No, that's all right. That's all right. I guess we'll segue now though into. Just critical response and reception. It was the highest grossing film in 1974. It didn't gross as much as the first movie did, but it grossed $47.5 million here on, and I think worldwide it's at about like $88 million or something like that. So that's
74 unadjusted. That was that would have been a huge film for that year.
Yeah, that's 74 money, and it's funny. It seems like critics were mixed on it when it first came out, because some were not a fan of the back and forth the back and forth narrative between past and present.
Now, I thought I read something though that there were editorial changes to this between the original theatrical cut and what is out now, and I tried to find that somewhere, and I'm not.
I believe it was test audiences.
Yeah.
Okay.
Test audiences initially balked at that. They found the going back and forth too confusing, and so
I think there was a lot more in the original cut.
Correct. And so you know, so that's why you get less. I think that's why De Niro's screen time's cut down, and you also get those title cards to tell you, hey, we've gone back to this point in time.
Yeah, and because I'm looking at some of the reviews here, and like, you know, Roger Ebert gave it, you know, 3 out of 4 stars, which, you know, I mean, it's still good, but, you know, not for the masterpiece we consider it today.
Right.
So I guess some critics were a little underwhelmed by it, but it since has grown a reputation.
Mm-hmm.
And of course there's, you know, you have the different camps. You have the people saying, well, is the original the better or is the sequel the better? And you know, I think I said this in our original podcast, Lou. I think I'm in the camp where I would rank the first over the second, even though I think they're both great. But the first to me is just that kind of perfect build, perfect narrative, perfect everything. And you know, it's not that The Godfather 2 is any less, but you know, it's that original impact that the first Godfather made. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, if they had just made The Godfather and never made another Godfather film, it'd still be one of the greatest films ever.
Yeah.
I don't think you could have made this movie without the first one. You couldn't have made the second without the first one.
No.
And I love that they fit together so well. Mm-hmm. And you could almost view them as one piece and say, well, it's the greatest 6-hour movie ever made. there's obviously great story, pulled off very well, super well acted. You mentioned it, deep bench, beautifully shot. Cinematography is amazing. So it checks all the boxes. It's just, it's not quite The Godfather 2. You know, I didn't say that right. Godfather 2 is not quite The Godfather.
Yeah, I'm with both of you. I'm in that camp of, I think the first one is a perfect film. I think it's a perfect film from frame one to closing frame. I think this is a near perfect film. So I don't think like it's certainly nothing to sneeze at to be lesser than what I think is maybe the greatest American film ever made. Uh-huh. But I think for me, the thing that because when I watched it this time too, I was trying to think, okay, what are people seeing that maybe I'm not seeing, and what are people getting out of it? And what I do think this movie has that the first one doesn't have is I think it has more of an actor showcase for its ensemble. I think the first movie is driven more by the narrative and more by moments that are created, like that horse's head and Sonny's murder and the baptism sequence, you know, which aren't necessarily actor pieces. They're more, you know, they're more set pieces that have been created. And there's some great acting scenes in this movie. Like there's Oscar reels for everyone in this movie. And so when you get those scenes, it's hard not to look at them and say, this is so much better because you're watching some like really meaty interpersonal conflict, which I don't think the first one has as much of. But I would say because the narrative's a little tighter in the first one, and also because the second one is saddled with having to shoehorn in and introduce some new characters in the beginning that we like, I don't think the movie does as well as introducing its new characters as the first one does.
True.
And there's some people I'm like, who is that again? Who is that supposed to be? And I don't, you know, and even after I've seen the movie multiple times, I'm like, I can't remember some of those people because they're not given enough time.
Right. Yeah. I'm looking at the Oscars for that year right here. 11 nominations, 6 wins, wins Best Picture, wins Best Director. De Niro wins Supporting Actor, but this movie gets 3 Supporting Actor nominations. You've got De Niro, Michael Gazzo, and Lee Strasberg all nominated for Supporting Actor. And then Talia Shire's nominated for Supporting Actress. Mm-hmm. And then,
there you go.
And then you get an Adapted Screenplay win, an Art Direction win, and a Score win. So, but 1974, that Best Picture race is pretty solid. Let me see real quick.
Who gets Best Director that year? Does Polanski get it for Chinatown then?
No, Coppola got it.
Did he get it? Okay.
Yeah, sorry, Coppola. He didn't get it for the first one because Fosse won for Cabaret.
Okay.
Yeah.
No disrespect to Bob Fosse, but okay.
But the Best Picture nominees that year are Godfather 2, Chinatown, The Conversation, Lenny, and Towering Inferno. Which one of these is not like the other? But yeah,
which one had a super, super high budget, though?
Yeah.
And the Academy wants money to get movies made. So that's why that one got in there.
Right. That is a hard, but between Godfather 2 and Chinatown, which I believe is a perfect movie as well. Mm-hmm. That is a very hard race. And so, but you know, for a sequel like that to win out, pretty impressive.
Bringing it back up a second then, because then I think we mentioned before that John Cazale was nominated. He was not nominated for Godfather Part 2. Is that what we're saying?
He was not. I was wrong.
Criminal. I mean, to me, he should have been and then should have really been in talks right up there with De Niro.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, absolutely. I guess Strasberg and Gazzo kind of have more, they have more like showy, very big scenes.
Sure.
Yeah.
Sure.
I'm not faulting
them at all.
No. I take Gazzo out and put in Cazale there, but you know, the Oscars with a near perfect record. So you can't, you know, you can't fault them for getting one nomination wrong. You know, they've done so well since. So,
but this is just what's crazy to me in that Best Actor race that year, because Pacino loses and Nicholson loses for Chinatown, and the winner is Art Carney for Harry and Tonto.
Like I said, Oscars, you know, okay.
So,
sometimes, you know,
that almost feels more like the Lifetime Achievement Award. It's like, we got to give this guy this one.
And that's what it was. And Nicholson would win the year after for Cuckoo's Nest.
Right.
It would take Pacino a while because he wouldn't win till 92 for Son of a Woman.
Son of a Woman, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah,
there's just the history of the Oscars is littered for actors winning awards over better actors for because they're due. And then that just cycle begets. Pacino loses to Art Carney, so then Pacino has to win. So when Pacino wins, he beats Denzel Washington for Malcolm X. So then Denzel Washington has to win for Training Day because he couldn't win, you know, and such is life.
Yeah, absolutely.
Right. Yeah, so, you know, not perfect, but it just proves that an Oscar win does not create the legacy of a movie. So, I mean, it's... Yeah, so we can go on about that on another podcast. So as we close out here, let's talk about something that you brought up, Lou. Is Godfather Part II the best sequel ever made?
I think it has to be. I think it's up there. I try to think. You know, people talk a lot about Aliens, Terminator 2. Mm-hmm. You know, I think you'd have to look far and wide for a sequel that. Certain, you know, Dark Knight,
yeah.
Probably might go there in terms of
maybe Empire Strikes Back.
Empire Strikes Back,
yeah.
You know, I think, yeah, but it's pretty rare air. But
but
I do think it does lay the groundwork to show that sequels don't have to just be soulless cash grabs,
right.
Because certainly these guys were all here for money. They could have just, you know, they could have half-assed it and put out whatever. But the fact that they didn't. And put out something that stands right up next to The Godfather is something that would come later in 1990 with Godfather III.
Yes, Coppola. You know, Coppola should let them talk him into it once. He shouldn't have let it be done twice. So,
well, and they actually
he kept trying to get out.
They kept trying
to get out. They pulled him back
in.
Well, and they famously wanted to do Godfather III in the late 70s with John Travolta. As Michael's son.
Ooh, okay.
So, you know, I'll let you listeners decide which would have been, if that would have been better than The Godfather 3 we got. But, yeah, I mean, I think that's the five, right, for sequels or any
yeah.
like...
I can't think of any major sequel before that, though, because, I mean, sequels were kind of a rare, yeah. Mm-hmm. You had certain, like, franchises during the golden years of Hollywood. You had, like, the... Tarzan franchise and like the Thin Man and all of that, but no like major sequel. So I think it is very rarefied air. Mm-hmm. So yeah. So as we close out now, just final thoughts on Godfather 2, Lou.
It's fantastic. It really does deserve another watch. We're going to be, we're all going to be kind of holed up in our homes for a while, it sounds like. So you're going to have some time on your hands. And I know the runtime is daunting, but I do think this is worth, if you haven't seen it in a while, it's absolutely worth a revisit. If you've never seen it, you must. I think it's a must watch.
Yeah.
It's up there. And if you know, watch the first Godfather, then watch the second one back to back. Or if you're super ambitious, you can go find the Godfather Legacy Cut. Which takes one and two and puts it in sequential order. As you mentioned, Eric, how it does kind of feel like one film. Coppola actually wanted it to feel like that, and he cut it, and then he had the money to cut it as such, so he did. So, go watch this movie. It's great.
Yeah, Eric.
Yeah, and there's a reason that we're holding it up. Right next to the original one. I mean, it's just as good. Probably best sequel of all time. And I agree with Lou. It's a must watch. I mean, it's top 10, top 15 movie of all time. If you're a fan of movies, you have to go see this one.
Yeah.
You'll find something in it. You know, if violence isn't your taste too, Lou, I think there is a version of that cut that they put out on NBC at some point that cut a lot of the violence out of it. So you might be able to find that somewhere too. But like we talked about, this movie's about family. I mean, there's violent parts to it, certainly, and it's a gangster movie. But what it really comes down to is the story, an American story of a family.
Yeah. Yeah, like I said, it's a very it's the epitome of an American story, and I think that's what separates it from other gangster films. And Yeah, as Lou, you like to put it, sometimes when you tell somebody this is one of the greatest movies ever made, it's eat your vegetables quality to it. But I don't think viewing of either of the Godfather, the first two, I don't think either of them have a eat your vegetables quality to them, because they are riveting from beginning to end. Yes, they might seem like a slower burn than movies that people are used to today, but I think they are just as compelling as they were back then. And I don't think they age. You know, you might say, okay, well, you know, this is a little dialogue heavy for something that would, you know, be released today. But when it's well-written dialogue, who cares?
Yeah. Right? And I also think there's something to be said for the fact that because it goes back and forth in between times, it's actually fairly digestible if you can't sit through it all the way. Uh-huh. I had to break it up for my rewatch. I didn't get to sit it. And I was like, okay, as soon as you know it goes back to a De Niro scene or we go back in the past, if you got to take a pause, go do something or, you know, come back to it. And I don't think you lose. It's more episodic that way than a typical film is.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. So, yeah, while you're stuck in quarantine for the next, you know, couple weeks, try out The Godfather. So as we close this out, Lou, do you have anything coming up this month with Guilty Pleasures?
Well, we just dropped a crossover with Flashbacks. We are venturing into another vaunted Hollywood franchise. We are starting our dive into the Tremors series. We started with a Flashback crossover with Ryan and Aaron, and we discussed Tremors 1 and 2. So we're going to break it into a three-part series, and sooner or later we'll do Tremors 3 and 4 as an episode, and then eventually we'll do 5 and 6. Because, yes, there are six Tremors movies, and we're going to watch every damn one of them. And then when Tremors 7 comes out, which it is in production, we'll do that one too.
Wow.
But, yeah, so that one's already out on our feed. So, yeah, you can go check that out. The other thing that I'm doing that I'm super excited about is it's March Madness at the Front Row. So on our Facebook page, I'm not quite sure when this is dropping. I'm assuming this is dropping relatively soon. You can go and vote on the greatest movie star of all time bracket. And when we do a bracket, we got to do a podcast with it. So we're going to be doing our annual bracket podcast, where we're going to break it down and we're going to fight and we're going to vote and we're going to crown the greatest movie star of all time from the 30s all the way to today. So it's a heck of a lot of fun. And I'm thinking we might even Facebook Live it if we can. So be on our Facebook page so you can see that, because you got nothing else to do. You ain't going out. So get on the Facebook and you can watch us drink some beers and argue about movie stars for a couple hours.
Awesome. Eric, anything coming up for you? I know a lot of stuff's been canceled.
Yeah, so a couple of things that I was involved in got canceled. I will say I was fortunate enough before the theaters were starting to shut down and move movies. My kids and I did go see Onward a couple of days ago. So it'll be, you know, a week or so ago whenever this dropped. That podcast, I saw that Vanessa Brett and some other folks were putting that one out there. So I'm curious to give that a listen. It's a Pixar film. I don't know if people will be able to go see it in the theaters, but if you can't, go listen to the podcast on it. It gives you what you want from a Pixar movie. So.
Also with that, I should mention on our coming up soon on our website, on NPR Illinois on the Community Voices tab, I know we got a couple of articles, some viewing guides for you while you guys are holed up quarantine. I know we as a team are putting together some of our recommendations of maybe some things that you missed or maybe just some comfort food stuff that's just fun that makes us smile. And so we hope you can check that out and enjoy and maybe follow some of our recommendations. But if you're in the mood for something completely ridiculous, you can also get my list of the top 10 greatest guilty pleasures of the 2010s. We're a little delayed on that one. We got kind of wrapped up in Oscar stuff, but turns out it's a perfect time to release it because that's 10 more movies that I wholeheartedly recommend if you are looking for some escapism, and Lord knows that I am, to turn your brain off and have some stupid fun. Those 10 movies, I can't recommend enough. So you can find that on our website as well. And I'm sure we'll post links on our Facebook page.
Yeah. Yeah. And one thing coming up for me, I don't think there's been a March in recent history that is more appropriate for Jeremy and Allison and I to finally do Mark's Madness. We're going to sit down and do that coming up, our tribute to the Marx Brothers. And we're going to be discussing Duck Soup and A Night at the Opera. So so for a March that seems very much full of anarchy, nothing better than to talk about the Marx Brothers. So we will.
Hail Fredonia.
Hail Fredonia. So the two of us have been talking about, the three of us have been talking about that for 2 years now. So finally going to sit down and do it. So hopefully to get that recorded by the end of the week. So a lot of content coming from us, but hey, we got nothing better to do. So.
And I'm going to put it out there right now. I'm penciling both of you in for our guilty pleasures on The Godfather Part 3.
Sure.
I will sit through that for that.
It's celebrating its 30th anniversary this year. So,
oh, it is.
Uh-huh. It is. If this quarantine goes on any longer, we'll probably do it by then too. So,
okay. Awesome. All right. So yeah, lots coming up. If you want any more information, you can find us on Facebook. That's where you can vote on our brackets. Find us, NPR Illinois and any of the other places. So for this edition of Front Row Classics, I am Brandon Davis.
I'm Lou Hare.
And I'm Eric Flick.
And we will see you in the front row.
This episode is a production of the Front Row Network, a proud Community Voices member of National Public Radio, Illinois. For more information and to see the full slate of Front Row Network shows, you can visit frnpod.com or nprillinois.org. You can also find and follow us on social media by searching for the Front Row Network on Facebook and Instagram, and Front Row Reviews with a Z on Twitter.